This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Everyone needs a smart best friend. Someone who can explain things simply and patiently. Someone who knows that no question is dumb or too crazy. Lucky for us, we have Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an astrophysicist and the host of Star Talk, where he talks about all things scientific, and he's ready to answer your questions today. Tyson is the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the Rose Center for Earth and Space in New York. He's also the co-author of the new book, Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military, co-authored with Avis Lang, a research associate at Hayden, and he joins us now from New York. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me. And you even pronounced my co-author's name correctly. She's Avis Lang.
Fantastic.
Yeah, very good.
Credit to our producer, Amanda Williams, for getting the pronouncer right. We like getting the facts on this program, and we'd like to get you some of the facts about
really?
Space.
Really? Facts?
Yes.
You care about facts?
Yeah, you
very
know,
good.
It seems to be an uncornered market. We figure we'll just stick with it.
And yeah, go for it.
You know, and if you'd like to get some of the facts about space and science or astrophysics and its relationship to the military, now's a good time. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A at WAMU.org. Let me start with the book, this alliance between astrophysics and the military. Give us a sense of what that is in a nutshell and why it is, as the title of your book suggests, so unspoken.
Yeah. So we already are familiar with the role that other sciences have played in warfare, especially engineering. You know, somebody had to invent the catapult when that first showed up on the battlefield. What an asymmetric weapon that would have been. Asymmetric in a military sense, where your opponent has something that you don't have and you're in deep trouble because of that difference. And so that, they call that an asymmetric advantage. So engineers, definitely. And if you look at the notebook of Leonardo da Vinci, where, yeah, he did art, but he also was a mastermind at sort of military machines that could lay waste to your army. So, and we know him as one of the greatest combinations of a scientist, engineer, and an artist. But moving forward, you think of the physicist as the person who builds the bomb, right? That was well known during the Cold War, especially. We also know of the chemist that, you know, would make chemicals like napalm and things like that. Going back to the First World War, where they would, you know, flood the field with mustard gas. The biologist might weaponize anthrax, for example. The astrophysicist, you make no such association, because we just humbly sit at mountaintops and wait for photons to arrive from across the galaxy, and then we carefully take the detector into the coffee lounges and debate what we saw. So that connection is not obvious. And so when I say the unspoken alliance between astrophysics and the military, it just never shows up. But in fact, astrophysicists, and in the earlier days, astronomers, have been fundamental to the growth of empires and the hegemony of nations. In particular, the need to navigate with precision around the world. Mm-hmm. My professional ancestors knew the night sky. And to know the night sky, and on any level, is to give you better advantage for navigating Earth's surface, because the sky looks different depending on where you are on Earth, and things rise at different times and set in different places. And so if you knew this, you can know where you're headed, where you're coming from, where the trade winds are, where the hostiles are, where the friendlies are, and all of this can be established. And there's no end of examples where this kind of information was exploited for the gain of the nation who had control over it.
I should note, we did have a conversation on this program, for those of you who are more interested in this connection between science and the military, about the origins of chemical weapons during World War I. A good bit of that heritage traces right back here to American University, which is the institution that owns WAMU, which produces 1A. You can find that conversation online at the1a.org. Neil, President Trump announced the creation of a Space Force this summer, a sixth branch of the military to focus on the militarization of space, although I guess it will be a fifth branch since the Coast Guard is technically part of DHS, which is also the topic of your book. Give us a sense of Give us a sense of what this Space Force would need to do, have, accomplish, avoid to be in the best interest of the American people and of humanity.
So, first of all, just to the Space Force is not a new concept, and it's surely been around even before I remembered mentioning it in 2001 in a commission I served on authorized by the White House to study the future of the U.S. aerospace industry, which at the time had fallen on hard times. They'd lost 500,000 jobs. There was consolidation in the industry. There was competition from Europe with Airbus and other places that were rising up, like in Brazil has Embraer. Canada was making regional jets. So there was a concern that, well, all right, what happens if we lose this industry? What impact would that have on our security, on our transportation, on our commerce? You order something from Amazon, it's on your steps the next morning, some airplane delivered it there, right? Or at least to the nearest airport.
Right.
So doorstep delivery by airborne craft is still to come, but we would call them drones, I guess. Mm-hmm. But so when you look at this problem, you say, all right, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, might we separate the concerns of the air with the concerns of space? Because these are the same companies, aerospace companies. That became a word, right? And if you separated it out in the military, you would then sort of tidy the budgeting for what the needs are, and you wouldn't have to compete under one umbrella for very different needs. At the time on this commission, there was a 4-star Air Force general, and the Air Force then and now controls space activities of the military. It's called the U.S. Air Force Space Command. And they said, we think we got this. We don't really need a space force separate from what's already happening. So I wasn't going to second guess the general, but I was intrigued by that confidence that he had. Fast forward to today, the Trump announcement, as well as the Pence follow-on announcement, if you just listen to it, it sounded very, very sort of macho, look how big my bicep is as I speak. It was very, we don't want to just be there. We don't want to just lead. We want to dominate. You know, there's a lot of this kind of language. Mm-hmm. And that spooked many people, particularly sort of peaceniks out there who's saying, oh my gosh, what will this mean?
Do you think that that's a bad thing, though? I mean, if the U.S. has, you know, supremacy, hegemony over space, our aims, you know, as a Western power might be a little more benevolent than, say, the aims of China or Russia or North Korea.
Yeah, sure. I'm just saying one could have said exactly the same thing using slightly different words, and it would have been less spooky to people who fear the future of what could happen if you, quote, militarize space. And so I was really referencing rhetoric, not reality. Reality is a space force, what would that mean? You would just take all the space activities that are already happening under the Air Force and slide them out under one umbrella, one sort of coherent umbrella. And if you're going to do that, I would throw in, you know, asteroid defense, all right? Why don't you, you know, put that in your portfolio while you're at it? That could be quite devastating to any place on Earth where a bad asteroid strikes, and in the limit, it could render us all extinct, as one did 65 million years ago with the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. And 70% of all species of life on Earth at the time. And that asteroid was only 6 miles across, and Earth is huge relative to that. It's a matter of the energetics and what it does to the climate and the atmosphere and the long-term survivability
right.
of the biota that requires the sunlight to feed it. So a space force might include, by the way, I would also throw in, why don't you clean up the debris that's up there while you're at the space debris problem. But so here's the distinction I want to make, which I haven't seen the press or the public recognize. Space, it's very hard and not particularly strategic to make space an active repository of weaponry. Holding aside the fact that that would violate a treaty to which we are signatory, and today more than 100 countries have signed, from 1967, it's a Peaceful Use of Outer Space Treaty, has a much longer name that I always forget.
Right,
but
right.
Those are the essence words from the title. And it's a very beautiful treaty. You feel like holding hands and singing Kumbaya as you read it, particularly at a time when there's the Cold War, but space activities were right on the rise. It was a really beautiful step taken by the United Nations at the time. So, and if your astronauts are in trouble, we have an obligation to come help and feed and all of this.
Right, right.
So what happens, if you start putting active, aggressive weapons in space, you are violating that space treaty, but also, what are you going to do with them? oh, you're going to swat satellites out of the sky? Because that's all that's up there. If you're in orbit, you're a satellite. If you do that, then you break the satellite into multiple pieces, each then become a lethal projectile moving at 18,000 miles an hour. Moving 18,000 miles an hour, which is the speed that you would have in low Earth orbit. And so now you have a debris field that you just created that not only can affect, you accomplished your point. You got rid of the bad satellite.
Right.
But you now created a debris field that can influence your own satellite. And this is strategically similar to, go back to World War One. You lace the field with mustard gas because you can't shoot your enemy in the trenches. Your bullet doesn't turn corners.
Right.
So you put the gas out there, and then the wind changes direction. It goes back in your face.
Let me jump back in there. I do want to get to some more of questions from our listeners, but we did hear mm-hmm. from one in particular who deals with these issues of the Space Force very directly in their work. Ryan wrote on our Facebook page, too many people think that it would be space soldiers out there shooting up other space soldiers and destroying enemy satellites and other spacecraft. As a NASA employee, I spend way too much time explaining that orbital mechanics, spacecraft propulsion, and navigation just don't work the way they see it on Star Wars.
Exactly.
We already know what happened when China destroyed one of their own satellites. That part of that orbit is now useless because of the debris. We are speaking to Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. His new book is called Accessory to War. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you are listening to 1A. Shall we mix it up and get to some different kinds of questions?
Let's do it.
All right. Here is a question from Maya, who left a note in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Maya Ramirez. I'm in Chicago, and I want to know what Neil deGrasse Tyson thinks is the best way to address people who are climate deniers and other people who totally disregard or are disinterested in matters of science that are by now well established, such as toxoplasmosis.
Maya, thanks for that question. I would ask, Neil, that if you keep your answers slightly pithy, we got a lot of questions we'd like to get to, so if you could keep it a little bit tight, we can get through plenty of them. But I love Maya's question, partly because, you know, my policy, my journalistic policy here on 1A is not to debate the merits of climate change with guests. If we book a guest who is a climate skeptic, we'll discuss the impact of that skepticism, but I'm not arguing as to whether or not the scientific consensus is solid. What would you say to Maya's question?
And you want me to be pithy? I'd be happy to. So I don't debate people ever. It's not my goal. My intent is to get people thinking straight in the first place so that going forward, they become thinking individuals who understand what science is and how and why it works. And then no one is left susceptible to this kind of thinking going forward, because science literacy is inoculation against charlatans, against fuzzy thinking, against all the other forces that are operating on us that would have us think something that is not true that is, or think something that is true that is not. So that's fact number one. What I generally do is I simply describe the consequences, as you just said, the consequences of thinking that way. It'll affect your health, your wealth, your security, if you deny the objectively true science that provides those things, those three things for us as we go forward. And the evidence for this would be we would watch America just fade in every important metric worldwide as the rest of the country just eats our lunch in terms of the economy, which relies on innovations in science and technology to grow. And if you don't understand what science is and how and why it works, just move back into the cave, because that's where we're going to be in the future.
We have so many questions on so many different topics. There is no way for me to string these into a coherent narrative. So we're just going to okay. We're going to knock them out in whatever way
go
I feel like
it.
Knocking them out.
Knock
Mary
them out.
Tweeted, I know astrology is anathema to science, but I'm interested if he sees anthropological or social or societal or historical connections between science and astrology. I had interest in astrology when younger, but no longer. Still, I think there are connections everywhere. Neil?
Yeah, so the first people who really cared about what was going on in the night sky were the astrologers. So early data taking cosmic data taking was done by people who believed that the universe influenced their life. You have to look back at what you were thinking at the time, that many thousands of years ago. Here you are, you wonder when to plant your crops. Oh, this star is, and the moon and the sun are doing this in the sky, and that's telling me that this is a good time of year to plant the crops. Oh, when the sun is over here, the Nile floods, or the irrigation channels open. And you would be left thinking that the whole universe knows about you, cares about you, is thinking about you, is keeping you alive, giving you signs and symbols and signals. And so this is a very, it's easy to see how you can be completely swept by this kind of thinking. What science has shown us is the exact opposite. The universe is cold. It is doesn't know or care anything about you. And the forces you want to assign to it, they're gravitational forces, obviously, and light is received. Take to it birth rates at full moons, for example. People say, oh, the full moon, the gravity. Well, the gravity of the obstetrician who delivered you on you is greater than that of the moon on you, okay? But no one is making, you know, no one is creating cults based on the weight of your obstetrician.
Of obstetric gravity, right.
Okay. So there are ways to calculate and show that all of this has no effect on you whatsoever, and that there's a cognitive bias where you remember the hits and forget the misses that leave you complete, that if you're susceptible to that, can leave you convinced that everything is happening around you and somehow knows and cares about you. And so am I going to chase after people who think this way? No, you don't. Like I said, you don't see me debating such people, but these people have ceded control of their lives to fictitious forces in the universe that cognitive bias continues to have them think is true.
Let me see.
And that's, I don't know how else to put it. A good course in astronomy and physics will help you, give you the mental resistance to this kind of thinking, and one in psychology as well, to know how the brain can be fooled into thinking that something is actually happening or statistically in your favor, that in fact is statistically random.
Much more to discuss as we continue our conversation with Neil deGrasse Tyson. His latest book is called Accessory to War. Lots of really good, interesting questions. John on Facebook wants to know if you believe in aliens. And Jay tweeted, which do you think will happen first? Transplanting a human brain into a machine chassis, like a robot body, or transplanting a human consciousness into a computer? Jay, that's a really interesting question. We'll get to that and many more in just a moment. Stay close. More with Neil deGrasse Tyson in just a moment, but first a question, particularly for women. In this political moment, how angry are you right now? Tomorrow's conversation deals with a long history of anger expressed by women in America and what it's meant for the country. What's your story? Have there been times when you chose not to get mad? Or maybe you grew up being told never to lose your cool? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Now, if you have let rip, or if you feel more empowered to let folks know exactly how you feel, what difference has that made? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. You can also use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio quality audio file. We will talk about women and this and other moments of anger tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Lots of good questions to get through. Let's see how many of these we can get through in the time that we have left. Ellie wrote on our Facebook page that she's a big fan of yours. Ellie writes, I have a job interview at Goddard today, the Goddard Space Flight Center. Do you have any suggestions on how I can slam dunk this thing? It's my dream to be able to work at NASA.
I think in this kind, in the world of exploring the frontier, not only a strong resume matters, but interpersonally, enthusiasm, I think, really matters. they want to know that you really care and you're in it and you have spirit energy that is spilling out of you, that your whole body, mind, and soul is ready to be given unto this grand adventure that we're all partaking in the exploration of space. So I think if you convey that, I don't know if it's a slam dunk, but at least it's a shot from inside the paint. If you want to stay in the basketball analogy.
Jay tweeted, which do you think will happen first? Transplanting a human brain into a machine chassis, i.e. a robot body, or transplanting a human consciousness into a computer?
So first, the human mind is really messed up. We have a lot of evolutionary baggage that prevents us from making rational decisions. It's also, we do some very beautiful things, our art and music and this sort of thing. To put a human brain into a robotic chassis, when you could program the robotic chassis to have almost anything you really care about, I don't see that as a thing that people will do. And the other option was what? To put a consciousness up.
Human consciousness into a computer.
Yeah, well, we don't really know what consciousness is. Evidence of that is how many books are still written on it. That's evidence that usually you don't know what it is. For example, if you look on the shelf of books on gravity, there's like 3 books. We got gravity. We're not still writing books on it.
It's the law.
It's the law. Yeah. Obey gravity. Right. So, but it's sort of uploading all of your electrochemical impulses into some machine to mimic that, to mirror that. Maybe that comes along with consciousness. We don't know, but I see that happening long before we would take a brain and stick it in a machine. By the way, speaking of transplanting brains, mm-hmm. what I really want is if we can't cure Alzheimer's and we can't cure ALS, at least find a way to transplant the brain of an Alzheimer's patient into the body of the brain of an ALS patient into the body of an Alzheimer's patient. And then you get a full person out of that. Because one, you lose the body. The other, you lose your mind.
This sounds very Altered Carbon. You've been watching a lot of Netflix, haven't you?
It's very Frankenstein, too.
It really
but
is.
But if you had goals, if you can't otherwise, I bet we'll find cures for both of those before we learn how to transplant a brain. But I think about that all the time.
Certainly hope so. Yeah. John wants to know, do you believe in aliens?
That's not a matter of belief. There's no evidence for life off the Earth yet, but we haven't looked very far or very much. Jill Tarter is one of my favorite quotes from hers is, if you go to the ocean and you stick a glass in and you scoop out some water and analyze the water really carefully and say, there are no whales in the ocean looking in your glass. No, you haven't looked. So we've only taken a tiny scoop out of the galaxy in our search for life. Intelligent life, for example, what we would think of as intelligent life, or any life at all in our backyard, our Mars and perhaps other places. But anyone who studied the problem is in no way doubts the strong likelihood that there's life elsewhere in the galaxy and the universe is possibly teeming with it.
Amy asked on our Facebook page, will the human race cease to exist in the next 1,000 years based on the current environmental trends, not considering a possible impact from an asteroid or other cosmic influence?
We're pretty sure that nothing extinction level is headed our way that would take us out in the next 1,000 years. And we know that because the more dangerous an asteroid is, the bigger it is typically, and the bigger it is, the easier it is to detect. We think we're good about that. It's possible that a comet could come from out of nowhere because comets, very long period comets, they sort of show up. You don't have history for them. And one could come in and take us out. It would be really bad luck if that were the case. But regardless, you want a healthy space program that can deflect these things. And so I'm all for building, protecting, having an insurance plan that you put a little bit of money in for to protect you against a devastating thing that it would be very rare. So, but otherwise, we could easily go 1,000 years if we become wise shepherds of our power and over nature, and we heed the warnings of scientists.
I wonder what your over-under is on that. I tend to be fairly hopeful. Younger people seem to have a very different grasp of the value of the earth, that this is the one home we have, than many of their parents and forebears. And I kind of, you know, today's generation gives me hope for dealing with some of the problems our climate faces. But what about you?
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm realistically hopeful. So, but I'm cynically hopeful. So here's how this works.
Cynically hopeful.
Yes. Yeah, so people don't act even when they're warned until it gets really bad, and then they act. So all of these dystopic movies that show, like, look at Blade Runner, right? Will it ever get to that point? No, because we reach it, or Soylent Green. No, because you reach a point where people say, no, I cannot tolerate,
like,
this any further.
I don't want to eat people.
I don't want to eat people.
Yeah, so that's just the bridge. That bridge is too far.
Right.
Right.
So we have restoring forces in the world that prevent swinging too low in this regard. And these dystopic storytelling, it involves a trend that then never stops and goes to rock bottom. And I've seen people bounce back. Societies bounce back. People in power bounce back. So how long are you going to deny science? Until it really interferes with your health and your wealth. Then you say, oh my gosh, I think I like science again. And then you put the funds back in. So that's why I think we'll be okay.
Jared submitted a question through our app, 1A Vox Pop.
Do you think that human beings are physically incapable of understanding the fundamental nature of the universe? If not, what's the timeline to solving, say, something like dark matter?
Good question, Jared. Neil?
So I think about that all the time. I lose sleep on whether – I'm going to slightly rephrase the question. I lose sleep over whether the human mind is smart enough to actually understand the universe as it is. And I worry that we may not be smart enough to even know what question to ask.
Hmm.
And this disturbs me because we, you know, who defines humans as intelligent? We do.
We do, yeah.
Who is to say that that is sufficient intelligence to figure out how the universe works? So now, dark matter, dark energy, well, the advantage to being modern human is that we can stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. You don't have to invent calculus to solve the next problem. Somebody else did. So in a way, we are assembling, rung by rung, a ladder of knowledge that looks over every next wall that we have confronted. And so so maybe the sum of all the intelligence of all humans, which is provided by peer-reviewed journals that are publicly available, as we all start where someone left off and take it further, that as we ascend, maybe we can be smarter as a species than we can as an individual. In a way, the termites make a termite mound, mm-hmm. but no one termite has any real clue that's you can do that, right? They just do their thing. Out comes this emergent property of being a termite. So maybe an emergent property of the human mind is that we can figure anything out at all. But I'm just saying that so that I'm not depressed when I go to sleep.
Before we get to more questions, can I just ask you briefly, you, as we said, you've gotten this reputation as America's favorite smart guy to ask all these difficult questions to. When did that become an interest of yours? You could very easily have just been an astrophysicist working on a darkened mountaintop somewhere waiting for photons. What is it about what is it about talking to the public about science that appeals to you?
None. It doesn't. I would much rather
stay
home.
What do you mean it doesn't? It must. I mean, we're doing this, aren't we?
No, I'm a servant of the public's appetite for knowledge.
So you don't enjoy this at all?
And for others, I'm a conduit to the cosmos that they seek. I'm a servant. And I may be delusional in this, but I'd look forward to the day where there are enough other people in this cleared field that others had cleared before I even got here. It's Carl Sagan, among others, cleared of its brush and bramble. And I'm there sort of bringing the universe to the public. The more people are in that field, the less work I have to do, and then I'll step backwards, and one day I'll exit the back door, and no one will notice. And I first go to the Bahamas, then I go back to my lab, and then you don't even know that I'm missing. And that's how I want to spend the rest of my years. So I do this because I can, and because I think it's for a greater good, not because I wake up in the morning saying, how am I going to bring the universe to the public today? Let me count the ways. It's just not my emotion. That's not how I think about what we're doing.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Laurie wrote on our Facebook page, do you still get flack about Pluto? Seriously,
yes.
Love you, Neil, but Pluto will always be my favorite tiny planet. And Danelle wants to know, how are you and Pluto getting along? Any regrets?
So the current generation of third graders are pretty cool with Pluto not being a planet. It's the people who were in third grade when Pluto was officially taken out of the ranks that they still have a chip on their shoulders, and every now and then come back. Although I did get a letter from a full grown person who said, "Dear Dr. Tyson, I studied the Pluto problem as an adult, and I finally agree with you. So I must apologize that I sent you a letter in third grade calling you a poo-poo head for your decision.
Wow.
This is a confession.
Would you please watch your language? This is NPR, sir. I mean, seriously. No need for that.
So Pluto, just to remind you, is like one-fifth the mass of our moon, has an orbit that crosses the orbit of Neptune. It's very different in so many ways from the rest of what we've been calling planets. By the way, I really didn't have a horse in that race. What I would like is more vocabulary than just the word planet. We have the rocky ones, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. They're tiny and rocky. You have the gas giants. Let's have different words for these different kinds of things so that if you say, I just discovered a planet around a star, you don't have to play 20 questions. Is it big? Is it small? Is it in the habitable zone? Could it support life? Is it gaseous? Does it have moons? Why do you have to play 20 questions? It means the word lost all utility. So I would like to see a future where we just have a more nuanced vocabulary to describe what orbits a star.
Let's get to another question from our app, 1A Vox Pop. Here's the one from Michael in Indiana.
Hello, my name is Michael Smith from Evansville, Indiana, and I've always wanted to ask Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson if he would consider running for president of the United States. I've always envisioned him running with Bill Nye, and Tyson Nye 2020 just sounds so great.
Michael, thanks for the question. What do you think?
Well, I'm flattered by the request. I was once asked that by the New York Times some years ago when there was some impasse in Congress that they wondered, well, maybe we need different kinds of people running the country. Consider that, and I've written about this before, think of how many attorneys have gone into political leadership in Congress and other levels of government. And as a lawyer, you're trained to win your argument. Even like no matter what, somebody pays you to conduct an argument and then you argue. Fold on top of that partisanship. So now you have people who are trained arguers on top of partisanship, and you ask, where is the convergence there? So I've always been a fan of wanting to get more people who in their day have to make decisions based on objectively true information, where they can get into a conversation with someone, an argument, and know before they begin that either one is right and the other is wrong, or the other is right and you're wrong, or you're both wrong. You have to have that awareness in you. Otherwise, it's just hot air. So what you need is just sort of more scientists, engineers, business people who make hard decisions every day. And I think that would change the nature of political discourse. I have no interest in running for any office because that implies you can just swap out the leader and everything will be how you want it. No. If you don't like Trump, remember that 60 million people voted for him. It's not about whether you like Trump. It's about what you think of the 60 million people. So as an educator, I prioritize not slapping politicians. You don't see me bad-mouthing politicians ever. That's not what I do. I want to educate the public so that when they do vote, they can vote in as most informed way as they can in the interest of their health, their wealth, and security, and the future of the nation.
Last few seconds before we let you go, you mentioned that you wish there were more public servants who were speaking to the public about science. If there were, and if you didn't have to be in the spotlight quite so much, what would you be studying right now? What do you wish you had more time to explore that you just don't before we go?
Oh, yeah. I'd be told my research specialty is galaxies and their evolution and how the stars within them behave differently depending on where they are in the galaxy, how the birth, life, and death of the evolution of stars in general. I would just disappear and you would not even know I exist.
Preferably from someplace in the Bahamas. I mean,
hey.
A cabana with an internet connection in them.
Yes. Find a mountaintop, not a lot of city lights.
Yeah, there you go.
A little bar next to it. I think you got the right idea. Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director of New York's Hayden Planetarium. His new book is Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military, co-authored with research associate Avis Lang. Neil, thank you so much for answering our questions. Thanks for talking to us.
Great questions from your audience. Thanks for having me.
This program was produced by Amanda Williams. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and keep looking up. This is 1A.
Don't you think they'd love to start all over and fly like eagles out among the stars?